From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. How do you tell another person's story of trauma? How do you tell your own? This hour, we'll take a look at how to tell this difficult story. When is someone's story of pain gratuitous? And when does it uplift the human spirit? And where's the line? We'll talk with journalists, researchers, and those who've bravely chosen to share their suffering with us. We hope this brings humanity one small step away from the abyss, and maybe even offer some insight into what it means to be human. First, Jessica Stern. She's one of the world's foremost experts on terrorism. She's interviewed and profiled the world's most dangerous people, often putting herself in harm's way. But as she approached her 50th birthday, Jessica Stern started to question her intense and dangerous work. Her questions led her back to October 1st, 1973, when Jessica, age 15, and her sister, age 14, were brutally raped by an intruder. The rapist was never caught. Years later, when the police reopened the case, Jessica Stern came face to face with her past. She writes about the experience in her book, Denial, a memoir of terror. Anne Strainchamps asked her why she went back to investigate her own rape.
Well, a couple things. One was I had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and though I didn't believe the diagnosis, I became curious about what had happened to me. And another thing that happened is that I was writing my third book on terrorism, and I included a little vignette about what it feels like to be terrorized, and my editor, as is his wont, told me to throw out the book that I had been writing and suggested that I write a book on the topic of my rape because he found that more interesting than yet another book on terrorism. And I was so offended that I didn't even bother responding for 6 months. But I also, when the police decided to reopen the case and discovered that it was a serial rapist of children, I got pulled in. I got pulled into the investigation, but I also got pulled in intellectually and emotionally into the story. And I just sort of fell into writing a book about it.
Have you, sounds like an odd question, but have you always known you were raped, or have there been times in your life when you've sort of forgotten?
I've always known I was raped, but I would say most of my life I more or less forgot about it. I put it way in the back of my mind. It wasn't something that I felt affected me in any way. And now, in retrospect, I realize that it affected almost everything, but especially my career choice. But even though it's pretty obvious to anyone who looks from the outside, to me, I was sort of the last person to know that the experience of being terrorized, raped at gunpoint, would definitely have an influence on a person's life, and also a rather surprising career choice that I made.
So you never really connected the dots and realized that the fact that you'd become an expert on international terrorism might have something to do with having been terrorized?
I never connected the dots. And it isn't just that I became an expert on international terrorism. I did something rather bizarre for an academic. I went around and I sought out the terrorists. I looked them in the eye. I interviewed them. And that's something that's really frowned on in academia. It's considered journalistic, which I'm sure you realize is not a compliment. Just as I'm sure if you tell your colleagues they sound like an academic, you mean they are boring and hiding the argument. So the feeling is mutual. But I didn't care. I just did it anyway.
Why?
Well, I think now I understand that I was, in a way, training myself to interview my own rapist. I was trying to exorcise something by understanding it intellectually. I was trying to understand how a person overcomes everything they've been taught about what it means to be civilized and does something that most of us would consider to be truly evil. And in the case of terrorists, it's killing non-combatants with a political agenda. In the case of a rapist, there's no political agenda, but the one thing they have in common is that they are violating normal moral rules and harming someone up close often.
Can you take us back some and tell us what actually happened the night you and your sister were raped?
Yes. We were in our former stepmother's house in a very, very safe town, Concord, Massachusetts, where everyone kept their doors unlocked. And a man came in the house with a gun. And both my sister and I thought it had to be a joke. It was completely beyond our wildest imagination that someone would actually come in the house with a gun and mean to harm us. And he spent about an hour telling us exactly what we needed to do or he would kill us. And he would say, you know, over and over again, he told us, you know, you'll put on this clothing, you'll brush each other's hair, you'll go upstairs, you must do this, I have a gun to your back. And then he raped us, and then when he was done, he cocked the gun, and we thought he was going to kill us, and then he told us that it was a cap gun.
How old were you?
15. My sister was 14. A number of the victims were 13. They were all between the ages of 9 and 19.
So one of the things that becomes clear through the course of your story is that suffering any kind of trauma has these profound, lasting psychological effects. You become, oh, it's like becoming colorblind in certain ways. There are things that you don't see. You also learn to kind of numb yourself out. So I guess that's part of what happened to you, that you learned to suppress a lot of feelings.
I did, and I thought it was an advantage, and I wanted to learn how to suppress feelings more. It seemed to me that feelings got in the way of work, and I only cared really about my work. Once I had a child, that protective mechanism, which really did make it possible for me to do the work I did, began to have high costs. And it was worth it to me to get treated for post-traumatic stress disorder. Those are symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, this numbing, alternating between being completely numb, not noticing things, not feeling things, and at other times being hyper-vigilant, hyper-aware of one's surroundings.
Well, we've talked about how having been terrorized as a young girl, you wound up gravitating toward the subject of terror and terrorists professionally. You also found, I guess ironically, that some of those psychological after effects of the rape turned out to be assets in your work.
Definitely. I think we can use symptoms creatively to do good work. And the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder often get in the way of intimate relationships, but they can be very useful for high-risk work. And since I've written the book, I've received so many letters from people, some women who were victims of the same rapist, some men and women who were raped in childhood, but some who are also explaining to me, I read this book, I realize I have post-traumatic stress disorder, I have those symptoms that you're describing, and I've been using them in my work.
So, for instance, how did you use some of those symptoms in your work?
I didn't feel fear. I didn't process fear as fear. I would sometimes, in fact, still feel quite agitated when I'm exposed to certain sounds that are normal, or I don't like spending time in shopping malls with buzzing fluorescent lights or a lot of ersatz scents. I'm almost phobic of that kind of environment. But sitting down and talking to killers in Pakistan, even terrorists I knew had targeted American civilians, I didn't understand that the kind of agitation I experienced in my body was fear. I experienced myself as being hyper-aware and also extremely calm. Mm-hmm. So I was able to do this work that, you know, in retrospect was really dangerous.
Earlier you said that you thought that you were kind of, through all the interviews of terrorists you had done, you were kind of working your way toward wanting to interview your rapist, that that was the kind of hidden motivation behind your choice of work. You weren't ever able to do that. He's dead, it turns out. Would you, if he were alive, want to interview him?
Absolutely. I had a fantasy that if I were able to look him in the eye and if he looked in my eye, that he would just explode, that he wouldn't be able to bear recognizing that I was a human being rather than just an object. That was my fantasy. I also wanted intellectually to understand what led him to do what he did. And though I wasn't able to talk to him about it, I did interview everyone I could find who knew him. And I believe that he was abused by one or more priests. That's not an excuse in any way for what he did. Almost every perpetrator has been a victim. Most victims do not become perpetrators. It's not an excuse, but it does help me to understand how he became capable of such monstrous crimes.
Jessica Stern is the author of Denial, a memoir of terror. And Strange Champ spoke with her. Later this hour, the harrowing and inspiring story of Ingrid Betancourt, who spent more than 6 years in captivity in the jungle of Colombia.
Well, you see, I think that for me, it came to a point where risking my life was not as important as risking to lose my soul. And my soul was threatened constantly by the treatment they were giving me.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. How do you tell another person's story of trauma? How long should you wait? How much sympathy should you show? And why make the victims relive their trauma? These were questions spinning in the head of Rana Rico-Rizzuto as she headed to Hiroshima to interview survivors of the world's first atomic bombing. But no question could prepare her for what happened when she arrived, the terrorist attacks on September 11th. Rana Rico-Rizzuto's book, Hiroshima in the Morning, confronts how the trauma of today can bring up the pain and suffering of the past. Here's Rana Rico-Rizzuto reading the opening lines of her book.
I can tell you the story, but it won't be true. It won't be the facts as they happened exactly, each day, each footstep, each breath. Time elides, events shift. Sometimes we shift them on purpose and forget that we did. Memory is just how we choose to remember. We choose.
The way you start this book, Hiroshima in the Morning, I can tell you the story, but it won't be true. It's fascinating, isn't it, to look at something that matters this much to you, and you know you won't be able to tell it all?
Yeah, that's kind of what happened to me when I went to Japan. I found out that nothing is true. You know, I had written a first book about the Japanese-American internment, and I had spent years interviewing internees there. And the fascinating thing to me was always that nothing was the same. Everything was true to one person or another person, depending on, you know, where they were at that time in their lives. And so everything is true, but at the same time, there's not that truth that we expect when we look at history.
So why, for you, did it suddenly become important? Why did you want to tell the story?
Well, there's kind of a long answer to that question, but in my first book, I had been looking at silences, and the silence that I was looking at there was the silence of the Japanese-American internment, which, again, I hadn't learned very much about that in school, but also my mother had been interned and her entire family had been interned, and we had never talked about it when I was growing up. So when the reparations happened, I found out in this big shocking family way that my family had been interned, and I went to make that story. And in the process of making that story, I ran into a great aunt of mine who had been interned, but she was more interested in talking to me about something else. She wanted to talk about Hiroshima because she had been in the internment camps, and when she was let out of the internment camps, she joined the occupation and she went to Japan, and she was one of the first Americans who saw the bombed city. My great aunt, single girl in her 20s, in a shiny black car with the doctors. They're going to house. They're visiting the mothers of stillborn babies. Molly is a file clerk for the Americans, or a statistician, but she can also be an interpreter. She can ask the grieving mothers for the details. Where were you when the bomb was dropped? She can ask for the body of the dead baby. I remember her every word. I thought we were helping. When she found out, and how did that happen, that she was the enemy, that the U.S. government was classifying all that information so no one could fully understand what the bomb did, that they were offering no help and no medical care, and here begins the outrage. That's when she became a peace activist. I'm almost sure that's what Molly told me. I had no other source of information, so it had to come from her. But when I returned, just over a year ago, surrounded by silence, suffocating, to really listen to her story, Molly had finally forgotten.
Are all stories like that? Are they all things that we didn't pay attention to the first time around?
I don't know, but I do think that you have to be ready for certain stories. And I certainly wasn't ready for that one. You know, I think that that's part of the question of memory and history and silences and how we allow those silences to happen, because at different times in our life, there's something that we're looking for and something that we want to see. And if we see it, then it satisfies our notion of what is and what exists in the world, and then we can go forward. And if we're not looking for that, sometimes we just, you know, it's like it's invisible.
Do you have to be careful when delving into stories that way? You know how much horror there is in the past. Do you worry about ripping open the wounds?
I tend to let people take the story where they want to take it, talk about what really resonated with them. But what I did find after September 11th was a kind of an opposite experience, which was not that I had to be careful not to rip people's stories open, but that they were so traumatized by what was going on in the world that they needed kind of a repository. So all of a sudden, I had people calling me and asking me to come and talk to them because they had the story boiling up inside of them and they had to get it out and leave it somewhere.
Did you feel as though your role in the discovery of this story changed for you when 9/11 happened? You are, I should say, a New Yorker, and your family was there, though not right next to the towers. So it must have felt very personal, even at such a distance.
It was quite an experience at such a distance. My husband was on the Brooklyn Bridge, and he saw the planes, and he was really in the middle of it, and yet he kept saying, "Everything is fine, everything is fine." And so everyone around me was very upset, because for them, you know, they're barely surviving on the idea that there's world peace and safety, and now there is no world peace and safety, and the people in New York are saying everything is fine, and it was a very surreal experience. But the thing that really happened with 9/11 for me and for the people that I was interviewing was that it shattered that narrative that they had created, and it left them with kind of the mess of what had actually happened, because all of their memories came back.
And as you say, they had constructed over a period of half a century a narrative that gave them a feeling of security and of comfort. And then they had to go back and start it all over again, too.
Right, right. I mean, it's a healing narrative. If you have any idea of what it looked like after this bomb dropped and the way that people died and the way that the skin just like peeled off of their bodies and they just kind of melted and incinerated and some of them didn't die right away. And so the families had, you know, several days of trying to deal with the pain with nothing. I mean, there was not even any clean water there. The nightmare of that is something that the human mind can't deal with unless it processes it down. And so it was very important for them to process it in order to heal. And then all of a sudden it was open again. And it was like, oh my God, you know, if the people who died did not sacrifice themselves for world peace, and if we actually don't have world peace, and if this might actually be something that could happen again because the United States is bombing Afghanistan and, you know, the lessons that we thought were learned have not been learned, then what do I do with that? How do I survive on a very basic human level? We ate the remnants of dried beans. They used to crush the beans to make oil and take the meat for food, and then they'd take the skin off, crush it together, and somehow make it into a round cake. That's what they were feeding the horses, but they kept some for human consumption, and I remember that was rationed too. We ate those. We would break them into little pieces and put them in the water and try to make some kind of soup. Pretty soon there wasn't even rice, not even brown rice. I remember eating any kind of leaf from any kind of vegetable and eating ordinary grass. When we ran out of vegetables, everything was eaten, anything edible. Here's another kind of thing we had to eat, inago, a small grasshopper. They said it had a lot of protein, nourishment, so we used to capture them in the rice fields. We'd dry it and cook it with shoyu or something, just to get the flavor. 71-year-old male survivor.
The stories, you use them regularly throughout the text. There's one later, a female survivor. It's the little things that matter, isn't it? She was lying on the ground, and she doesn't remember or doesn't talk, I think, about her own pain so much, but she mm-hmm. remembers a woman carrying a mortar.
Right, right. And then she put it down, and then she died.
And that's what, clearly after half a century, still springs to mind for her. How do you find a story like that?
I just sit and listen, and sometimes it takes quite a long time if you're doing it in two languages and you have a translator, but I let people go where they need to go. And I had an experience once where a friend of mine she's an amazing simultaneous translator. We were in a park and she said, well, let's ask a question. And I asked, what do you think about war? And I had this one woman come up to me and she started talking about Afghanistan and talking about the kamikaze boys who had sacrificed their lives. And she was looking at me and I was looking back at her. And the fact that she felt seen, she just poured everything out. I would nod and I would look at her and I would hold her gaze. And she just went to the place that she needed to go. And it all gets collected on tape and, you know, transcribed and all that kind of stuff. But it's that human connection that if you are present for a person, if you will be their witness, they bring up what they need to bring up.
Rana Rico Rizzuto is the author of Hiroshima in the Morning. Ingrid Betancourt was campaigning for president of Colombia when she, along with nine others, was abducted by Marxist FARC rebels in 2002. She spent the next 6 years in captivity deep in the jungle. Because of her status as a presidential candidate, her captors singled her out for unspeakable and extreme humiliations. Finally, in 2008, she was rescued. Ingrid Betancourt writes about her ordeal in her memoir, Even Silence Has an End. Steve Paulson spoke with her about the resilience of the human spirit.
From your account of this, and it's really just an incredible ordeal that you write about, it seems like they repeatedly tried to humiliate you. They tried to rid you of any dignity you had left.
Yeah, I think it was a constant. For them, it was part of their revenge. And they would do very cruel things. I mean, I was chained to a tree by the neck for almost 4 years. And for all that time, I was forbidden to talk to people around me. And this was a punishment for having tried to escape.
Which you tried to do repeatedly. I mean, it wasn't just once or twice. It was a number of times, right?
Yes. It was my obsession.
So even though each time these escape efforts failed, I mean, they captured you, I mean, then they would beat you, they would starve you, as you say, they chained you, they often would forbid you from talking to anyone around you. I mean, it sounds absolutely horrible, and yet you kept trying.
Well, you see, I think that for me, it came to a point where risking my life was not as important as risking to lose my soul. And my soul was threatened constantly by the treatment they were giving me. You see, the problem is that once you're abducted and you lose your freedom, you lose the sense of who you are, because we are the choices we make. And once we cannot make those choices, then we don't really know who we are anymore. And they were treating me as an animal and as an object. They would refer to us as the cargo. And I could see that if I wasn't aware and vigilant, it would harm me in a way that I was afraid I could never recover. I remember, for example, the time they wanted us to respond to a roll call. And they began shouting that we had to count ourselves. And my companions would answer, the nearest to the fence would say one, and the next said two, and so on, until it came to my turn. And once I was confronted to having to answer, well, I couldn't answer giving a number. And I said, Ingrid Betancourt. And then I realized that this had triggered a very big aggressivity from my guards. So I tried to explain, and I said, look, if you want to know if I'm here, if I haven't escaped, you call me by my name. I mean, this was very badly received by my fellow hostages, who didn't understand why I was answering in a way different than the way they were answering. And they began criticizing me and saying, why do you act like this? Do you think you're better than all of us? What is your problem? It's a very arrogant attitude. And for me, it wasn't an arrogant attitude. It was just that I couldn't respond in a way that I thought was going to make a difference in the way I was perceiving myself. I didn't want to play with that. And I told them, look, I think they want to transform us into objects. And for them, treating us numbers is easier because they know they have to kill us. One day they will receive the order to kill us if there's a military rescue. And they want to just, you know, dehumanize us. And I don't want to play that game. I don't want to accept this. But it was difficult. And of course, in a situation of as abduction, you are confronted to those type of decisions of accepting things or not accepting them. And when you don't accept them, of course, you're punished and you're treated in a harsh way.
And certainly from your account of this, I mean, yes, it was truly horrible. And there was almost, it seems like a kind of psychological warfare you waged with them, because you didn't want to just be humiliated as they were trying to do that to you.
I mean, for me, it came to a point where fighting for my dignity was everything I had left.
Now, you were held captive for more than 6 years. I mean, just an incredibly long ordeal in the middle of the jungle. Did you ever lose hope?
I always thought I was going to get out of there and that I was going to escape no matter what. But of course, I remember one moment where I became very ill and I didn't have any medication and my body just stopped functioning. And then I thought that perhaps my best option was dying, because it was a sort of escape. And I thought it would be a relief for my children not to have to wait for me anymore and be able to continue to their normal lives. So even though it was not losing hope, it was losing hope of getting out of there alive.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the day finally when you were freed?
Well, that was an amazing day, because I had dreamed so much of being rescued. And that day, everything was everything but not a rescue. I mean, imagine what we were seeing. We had been told that a humanitarian commission would come to talk with us. And so those helicopters came and landed, and we saw some guys coming out of the helicopters, and they were so friendly with the guards, and they seemed to work for the guerrilla. So when they told us that we had to get into that helicopter, it was clear for us that we were going to be transferred to another camp, deeper in the jungle. And when we got to this helicopter, pushed by the rifles of the guards, and we took altitude, then I saw this incredible scene of the people that had come in that helicopter wrestling to the commanders, the two commanders that had got into the helicopter with us. And those two commanders were neutralized by these guys. And in a moment, one of them shouted, "We are the Colombian army. You are free." And we couldn't believe it. It was more than a miracle. And so I remember I was screaming, but in a way that it was not a rational thing to do. I mean, it wasn't me wanting to scream. It was me screaming without my authorization in a way. And I was thinking, oh my God, what? This is very strange. I'm acting very weird. I'm acting like a crazy person. I have to stop screaming. And I couldn't. I was screaming. And then I looked at my fellow hostage and everybody was doing the same. They were jumping. They were kissing. They were screaming. And I thought, oh my God, we're going to crash. You know, because this was too good to be true. So I remember I asked the pilot, I motioned to him how long this flight will go. And he said five minutes. And those were the most, I mean, eternal 5 minutes I've ever lived in my life. Mm-hmm. And when the helicopter landed and the doors opened, the sensation of being reborn, it was the end of the nightmare.
I want to ask what it was like for you to write this memoir, because of course you had to relive these 6 incredibly difficult years. And at one point you write, "Some facts are too painful to be told. In revealing them, you relive them." And you go on to say, "If you share certain things, they will stay alive in other people's minds." Which makes me wonder what you decided to keep private and what you chose to write about, to tell the rest of the world.
Well, writing this book was very hard. I mean, the purpose of the book, I mean, of course, it's a journey in abduction, it's a journey in the jungle, but most of all, it's a journey in the soul. And what I wanted to share with people is what happens to your soul when you're confronted to those things. And what I chose not to tell were things that wouldn't add anything in the comprehension of that transformation of the soul, which is what this book is about.
Was it healing to write this book?
Yes, now I can say it's healing. When I was writing it, I thought it was just opening the wounds again. But now that I did it, I think that I'm better off, because I think that I got perspective in many things. And it helped me first forgive myself for things that I wasn't too proud about. And by telling those things, it just, you know, once it's out, it's out. You just feel better. It's like a confession. And then I could forgive everybody. That was a major achievement of this book. I could forgive everybody.
Including the guerrillas who abducted you?
Yes, including the guerrillas. And including, when I say the guerrillas, there were guerrillas that were particularly vicious, you know? That I have had so many nightmares that when I awake, I just want to continue running away from them. It's very difficult. But I know that now in my heart, in my emotions, I could see them again and I wouldn't feel hatred. And that's, for me, it's the true freedom.
Ingrid Betancourt's memoir is called Even Silence Has an End. Steve Paulson spoke with her. Betancourt says she is in the process of healing the many wounds from her captivity. Ingrid Betancourt now lives in France. She no longer has any involvement in Colombia politics. Later this hour, the founder of StoryCorps on the power of telling your story.
We hear at StoryCorps very often that people talking about how the 40 minutes in the booth is, you know, among the most important 40 minutes they've spent in their life often.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you're like me, you look forward to StoryCorps every Friday morning on NPR's Morning Edition, where you hear powerful first-person narratives by Americans of all backgrounds. StoryCorps started in 2003, and since then has collected and archived more than 30,000 interviews. Each conversation will be preserved at the Library of Congress. Anne Strainchamps recently caught up with the founder and president of StoryCorps, Dave Isay, in his office in New York City.
I think I'm still pretty surprised by the emotional reaction people have to the pieces. You know, the most common comment we get, and we get dozens if not hundreds of these every week, is people talk about how every Friday morning they cry when they hear StoryCorps, which is interesting because, you know, most of the stories aren't actually sad. But I think that there's something about hearing in this kind of world of commercialism and phoniness that we live in, where everything's kind of an advertisement, everyone's trying to sell you something, except on public radio, of course, that hearing people speaking authentically and speaking from the heart about their lives is something that's very powerful for people. And I also think that in many cases, that the stories that we play are really people talking about humanity at its best. I mean, it's often people bringing someone to the booth who's kind of an angel in their life, who they're honoring. And in hearing these stories of kind of everyday people's kind of courage and kindness and so forth, it's almost sort of, I guess, walking on holy ground. And that becomes a very emotional experience for people. So even the funny stories have people crying. So that's been unexpected, very strange, but, you know, it's wonderful.
Can we hear an example? There's a story, I think you brought this one, with Kim Emerson and Gladys Chen.
I actually haven't heard this story in many years, but this is a woman named Kim Emerson whose sister, Kendra Webdale, was pushed in front of a subway by a mentally ill individual. And they ended up creating a law called Kendra's Law that had to do with making sure that folks were stable before they were released from psychiatric institutions. And she had a chance to sit down with her friend Gladys and talk about the day she found out about her sister.
I was at home, and I got a phone call from actually a reporter or a journalist from the New York Post. And I just let it ring. I was just screening my calls. And she said, "Are you the sister of Kendra Webdale?" And so I heard that, and I like hopped up to go get the phone. She said, "That was killed on the subway." And, like, as soon as I heard the word killed, I went to a different place, a place that I've never been before, that I felt like I was kind of out of myself. I never knew what going into shock was, and now when I look back, it was definitely that type of feeling, but I just remember falling on the floor, and I was just screaming. I was making noises that I didn't even know I was capable of, because there's nothing in my life that ever made me scream like that or make a noise like that. And I actually, later, I must have been eating an Oreo because there was Oreo, like, all over the floor. And the worst part about the whole day was knowing that I had to tell my family. And I remember standing by my bed and thinking to myself, right now, they don't know. Like, right now, life is good. And I'm going to tell them something so horrible that's going to change their lives. And I don't want to do it. And I just remember, like, waiting, just minutes, knowing I had to, but just waiting to give them more moments of peace. And there was one voice message that Kendra had miraculously left. I had the old answering machines, and there was a little tape in it. And there is a full message from Kendra.
It's Kendra. It's Monday night at about 10.
I know every inflection in her voice. So she's actually talking on it and talking for like a couple minutes. And in the end, she's like, okay, bye. I love you.
I love you. Talk to you later. Bye.
That is the one thing that I have with her voice on it. And it's one of the most valuable things that I could ever have.
That story really does break your heart. I mean, I can't imagine being the StoryCorps employee in the booth listening to and transcribing it. The first time I heard it, I had to stop and cry and then call my own sister. What do you do, and what does it do to you to witness a story like that?
I know the facilitators tell me that often at the end of the day, many of the interviews are about parents, you know, or with parents. And often at the end of the day, facilitators will get on the phone and call their parents, their mom or their dad, and just say, you know, I love you, or I'm thinking about you. So that's kind of a common reaction to both being in the booth and, I guess, listening to stories as well.
Kim's story is an example of a story from the traveling StoryCorps booth. But you've also sought out specific stories as well. You have a September 11th initiative. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. StoryCorps is a general oral history project. We're all over the country recording everybody's stories. But we also early on decided that it was important to take on some special initiatives to ensure that we could collect important stories around specific issues or groups. And the first special initiative we took on was the September 11th initiative. It's still going on. And that is in partnership with the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, where we're working to collect one story to honor everyone who was killed on September 11th. 2001. And, you know, when StoryCorps started, I had a sense that we would see a lot of folks who were dealing with illness or end-of-life issues coming to StoryCorps when they could, and that's something we did see. But what didn't occur to me was that we would see a lot of people come to StoryCorps to honor people who had died. And, you know, one of the interesting things about these 9/11 interviews is that, you know, we'll see firefighters come to StoryCorps who haven't talked about their experiences before and will come to the booth and cry and, you know, would never consider going to a therapist because they would think of it as self-indulgent. But something about leaving this record for history gives them the license to come in and talk about their experiences. I think we have one clip here to play, and this is John Vigiano, who came to StoryCorps to remember his sons, John Jr., who was a firefighter, and Joe, who was a policeman. And they both died at the World Trade Center. And John did come in by himself.
There were a couple of days each year you were allowed to take your children to work, and Joe loved it. That was his birthday present, that he would come and spend the night in the firehouse. We'd have a cake, and the guys I work with, they would take a milk container, and they'd cut out the facsimile of a building, and they'd put it on the top of the cake, and then they would light it up, and they would tell Joe to put it out, and he would throw a pot of water on it. The birthday cake was a little soggy, but this is what he wanted. Joe started dating a young lady whose father was a police officer. And he come home one day and he says, I'm taking a police test. I says, Joe, you're only 17 years old. He says, ah, no big deal. He passed the test. And when he graduated, they assigned him to East New York, where I started my career. On the other side of the room, my son, John, wanted nothing to do with police or emergency service or fire department. He wanted to be the next Donald Trump. He was going to make $1 million and take care of his mother and father. But in 1984, I came down with throat cancer. He noticed then how my unit took care of us, and he says, I'm going to become a fireman. I says, you're kidding me. Firemen don't make millions of dollars. How am I going to live like a king? But I was very happy, very proud. My father had been on the fire department, and he was the first one to be issued badge number 3436. And when John decided he wanted to be a firefighter, they reissued it to my son, John. So the badge was only used by two. Both the boys would call me when they were working. John would always call around 3:30, 4 o'clock. And that particular night, September 10th, we spoke for a few minutes. And I says, I love you. And he says, I love you. Joe called me in the morning and told me to turn on the television that a plane just hit the Trade Center. He says, I'm heading south on West Street. This is a big one. And I just said, be careful. I love you. I said, I love you too. That was it. We had the boys for John for 36 years, Joe for 34 years, ironically. Badge number 3436. I don't have any could've, should've, or would've. I wouldn't have changed anything. There's not many people that the last words they said to their son or daughter was, I love you. And the last words they heard was, I love you. So that makes me sleep at night.
David, you waited until about 2005 to start the September 11th issue. Why wait more than 4 years after the event? And why not record these stories right after they were happening?
We are not a first responder project. You know, when something tragic and terrible happens, like September 11th or Katrina, you know, the first needs are basic needs having to do with survival and food and water and so forth.
You don't want to get in the way.
That's not us. Yeah. And we don't want to get in the way. And that is not a place we can be of service. So we found that StoryCorps is much better suited after people have a chance to take a breath. You know, it's a project where you really do have a chance to stop and take a deep breath and look at each other and in this kind of silence of the booth, you know, have these conversations. And as you know and can imagine, that in the wake of a disaster or tragedy, silence isn't really the operative word.
The September 11th initiative isn't the only kind of disaster-related initiative. You also went to New Orleans to record stories about Hurricane Katrina.
Yep.
How did that come about?
You know, it's the same sort of thing. I mean, I think it was a year, maybe a little bit longer than a year after Katrina, and we went down. It was a smaller initiative. We're actually down in Louisiana again doing BP interviews right now. Yes, we went down when we felt that it was appropriate for us to be down and record these stories, and we did, I believe, several hundred interviews with families who were impacted by Katrina, both in Louisiana and Mississippi and elsewhere.
Hmm. Can we hear one?
Sure. This is a man named Douglas DeSilvi, who came to StoryCorps to talk about losing his wife and daughter and mother-in-law in Hurricane Katrina.
My name is Douglas Paul DeSilvi. I'm a native of the Gulf Coast. The story I want to tell today is about my family. The three women in my family have steered my life for the past 59 years to the man that I am today, and I hope and think that I am a pretty good fellow. Every time we had a hurricane, we would all go over to Nadine's home. We consider this just another storm. Since 77, when she built this house, we've been through every storm in it, not knowing what we were in for. We were sitting on the bed, and I could hear glass breaking, and I walked to the back of her bedroom, which was facing the bay, just to measure the water to see how high up it was. And in the back, the water just came up so fast, it was unbelievable. As I turned and told them to hold hands that we was going to have to get into the water, the roof came down on all of us. And my lungs started filling up with water, and I just kept asking Jesus not to let me go like this. I had to get my family out. I got out, and they didn't. I'm a big guy. I'm 268 pounds. I exercise and stay healthy. I could not do a thing. It was just their time to go. The only way I can understand this. Losing a family is, I don't think there's any words for it. Kind of makes you wonder what life's all about. Many, many questions I have not received answers for yet. I just don't know what I feel these days. I wake up and go to my office and do my job, and I come home. I've got the house full of their belongings and that I don't know what to do about. You know, when as a father and a dad and a husband and everything, you always plan for the future of everybody, and it's just the opposite now. I have nobody to plan for or work on retirement for or save for buying a house, or it's just me.
That one's so hard to listen to.
Yeah. But again, I mean, I think that people who record these stories, you know, we know from talking to people after they've done these interviews that it becomes very important to them to have a chance to have these conversations and to leave a record of what happened and make sure that they feel like they've been heard.
Does it help people to tell their stories? I mean, do they feel better after they walk out of the booth having just told a story like that?
In my experience, the answer is, you know, uniformly yes. I mean, they don't come to the booth unless they want to tell these stories. I think it's cathartic. I think it's extremely important to people. You know, if you're talking about something like the 9/11 Project, you know, leaving a record, it's not a record of what happened on 9/11 only. You know, it's a record of who, you know, their brother, their son, their father, their mother was as a person. We hear at StoryCorps very often that people talking about how the 40 minutes in the booth is, you know, among the most important 40 minutes they've spent in their life often. We're starting a end-of-life initiative called Legacy Initiative, people who are dealing with death and dying. And a man named Ira Byock, who's a great palliative care doctor, came to StoryCorps to talk to us last week. And he wrote a book about the four things to say before you die, which are thank you, forgive me, I forgive you, and I love you. That's something that palliative care folks suggest that people say who are facing end-of-life issues. But I think it's, you know, I think it's the kind of conversation that's important for us all to have because we're all, in one way or another, facing the end of our lives. And if you think about that John Vigiano clip, the importance of having the last thing that he ever said to his children be, I love you, which is just such a profound and important and true message.
David Isay is founder and president of StoryCorps. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Telling the Difficult Story, program number 117A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Special thanks to Brad Kohlberg. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.